At the Races with Steve Bick. Horse racing, handicapping, interviews. This is At the Races with Steve Bick.
We're back. Call it hour two. Second hour. We're about 20 minutes in, and Rich Bigliori's back from either, I don't know, gathering eggs maybe out of the coop, herding the milk goats. What were you doing?
I'm trying to get all of the vehicles' oil changes and service. I try to do them all the same day because this way I'm on top of it, and I've been rotating. Right now, my car's getting done, but I already took the farm truck to get done and then ran back to the house. And there's a dead zone in between, and I kind of got caught, so that's why I called you, just texted you, let you know that, because then I got to run back and get Carmela's Jeep, Gabby's car. So I need to get this all done so I can just have tomorrow free to go hiking.
Nice. All right. All right, I wasn't sure. You being occupied around the house, around the farm, could be anything.
So. Yeah, no, there's always a lot of work to be done. We have this, farm vehicle that I use when I need to go get boards or I need to pick up stuff, because you constantly are fixing fencing. That's the one thing they don't tell you when you buy a farm. You're constantly fixing something, but fences in particular, and. I had another tree fall. Whoever planted these, whenever they were planted, didn't realize that these particular kind of pines did not have the deepest root system. And, if we get a real big wind, inevitably one of them is coming down. And another one went down last week. So I had to deal with that all week. In between running down to Belmont and doing America's Day at the Races, which it's funny when you go to work to get rest.
Exactly. It's the opportunity to, you can just be focused and not have, more on your mind than the task at hand. What was your, I can't remember Saturday, what was your shift on Saturday? Did you have to, you didn't do the night. I think the night was LaDuca and Greg, right?
Shift. They went to the end. I was on from 1 to 3, and then there was an hour break, and then I was on 4 to 8:30. So I did a 6.5-hour shift on Saturday. I think they kind of know better than to put me on past 8:30, because literally my bedtime is between 9 and 9:30. So they wouldn't. I think they know they wouldn't be getting the best of me. But I still did a 6.5-hour shift, which is honestly a lot of TV. I was glad it was broken up. I did 2 hours reporting, which kind of flies by because you're in the paddock, you're exchanging, ideas and talking with people, and then you're back in the winner's circle and you're doing interviews. That goes fast. And then the hour break, I actually ate something, so it kind of picked my head up again, and then the 4 hours on the desk, 4.5 hours on the desk can be a little tough. I know people, I tweeted something, and more I was trying to compliment the people behind the scenes, because we have an incredible crew of people behind the scenes that they genuinely make the shows what they are. And not to belittle what I do or what any of the other on-air talent does, but the grunt work, the hard work, is really the people behind the scenes. And so I tweeted out something complimenting them and just saying, I hope people realize how much hard work goes into this. And, of course, somebody's got to jump on, you got a great gig, what are you complaining about? Well, I wasn't complaining, but I will tell you that, you do get kind of stiff sitting there for long. I got to remember to stand up when we go to commercials and just move around a little, because it's hard to sit that long.
No, no doubt. No doubt. I'm, some people have said, don't you want to, over the years, they've said, don't you want to do the TV? No, I don't. No. I would feel kind of confined, frankly. Especially because I got the best thing, Monday through Friday, and, Friday noon, I think particularly when we're at, these big 2-day events, whether it's Breeders' Cup or Triple Crown or, Big Saturdays, anywhere. And, you know, I get done Friday noon, and I got, you know, I got the next 2.5 days. I press the flesh and you know, kiss babies and slap backs. You know, I got the best thing there is. I got the best gig there is.
You are the unofficial mayor of racing, though. You like flow into any racing town, and it's like, you know, the parades begin, the party starts.
It's ridiculous. Before we talk about the weekend action, I do want to point out, you know, in addition, obviously, to preparing for the on air, there's also, you know, the features, and you in whenever you. You know, whenever you've been engaged for this kind of work, you like the, you know, the storyline features, the featurettes and stuff. And I can think back, you know, you had that series where, you know, for 90 seconds or 2 minute video clips, you know, the horse or the people behind the name of stakes. Remember when you did those?
History of the game. I love
the history of the game.
Yeah,
like that. Those were really fun. But you did this thing with Barbara Livingston that aired as well, and we should point out.
Well, you know, I mean, it's just such a fascinating thing that she has Jim Raftery's entire photo collection. And the way he even would stage photos was way ahead of his time. Like Swaps breaking the world record for a mile, and they've got a police officer giving Rex Ellsworth a ticket while he's holding Swaps because the speed limit was like 40 miles an hour and he went faster. You know, like they just very creative, innovative things like that. You know, like, and coming across these photos. And she's got so many that she's going through and cataloging. So when we run the feature, you know, Jody Petrovsky is doing an amazing job. She will get some of the new photos sent to us. So, like, the other day, there was some Nashua photos, and we ran the feature, and we come out of the feature and talk about Nashua. And I love the history of racing. I read continually about, you know, horses from, you know, Man of War and before and to current day, and John Sheriff's actually, I've got his book. I got to get it back to him. This incredible book he lent me. And then he sent me a book as a gift by Colonel Matt Wynn about creating the Kentucky Derby and promoting it and how it became, you know, was becoming America's race as he wrote this. And so I really, like for me, that's my fun zone. I love learning about that stuff and the different history. And then if I can share it, and one of the things the feature with Barbara has done has, you know, opened us up to, you know, being able to share it more, coming out of it and having a photo of Nashua, a photo of, you know, Carrie back and talking about the breeding by Saggy out of Joppy and what those were. Saggy's claim to fame beating Citation and at Harve de Grace. And, you know, so I love that. That's when I kind of brighten up. That's not even like work to me. That's you know, me wanting to talk to people about horses and racing and the history. And we have such a rich history. Steve, I might have told you this story, but you know, as a kid in Mr. DeMauro's barn, we had an elderly gentleman. He was too old to even groom. He was in his 90s, but Mr. DeMauro kept him on the payroll, and all he would do is sit on a bale of hay and hold horses and ice. That was his job. But in the evening when we'd all have dinner together, you know, particularly in Saratoga, one of the picnic tables by the barn, he would get to telling stories. And he was the groom of Count Turf, who won the Kentucky Derby in the 40s. And he would talk about taking the train from New York after the Wood Memorial to Louisville with the horse. And, you know, his name, everybody called him Yankee. I don't honestly know his given name, but he was Yankee. You know, little elderly black gentleman who would always correct my grammar, my English. You know, I would say something. I was a kid out of Brooklyn, like, hey, we ain't got no tomatoes or, you know, whatever, right? And he would say, Richard, you speak properly. And he would correct me. But kind of that was, to me, like this, it opened this window or opened this door into how incredibly rich a history racing has, because I didn't think about it in that context until Yankee would start telling stories. And traveling to Hialeah in the winter and the places where they could eat or not eat or where they could use a restroom or not use a restroom, things like that. And, you know, and just the fact that in that era, somebody would be kept on the payroll because, you know, they needed a place, they needed a purpose, they needed, you know, a job, whether it was just to sit on a bale of hay, like Mr. DeMauro understood and appreciated how important a role he still was in the barn because of his, you know, his ability to teach and his ability to keep everybody's morale up and you know, keep us almost like an uncle, you know, that kind of like a very steadying, you know, influence in the barn, and had seen, you know, more than any of us had ever seen, just was at an age where he couldn't, actually groom horses anymore. But, you know, it was a wonderful, wonderful time. I remember our day watch lady, a lady from Aiken, South Carolina, when I was getting ready to ride, knew that I was going to need socks and underwear, and told me to go buy, you know, several pairs. Joey D'Angelo's parents owned the little department store across the street where everybody would go to cash their checks. And, you know, came back and she embroidered my name in all the socks and underwear and T-shirts because she knew they would get thrown in the community laundry in the jockey's room. Like, these were the kind of people, you know, that basically helped raise me. They were my, you know, my family. They were amazing. And I got off track, but getting back to where this began, that is all about the history of the game and the great horses and the great people that have made racing, to me, the greatest game played outdoors.
Right. You know, you mentioned, I just put up the link to the video feature that's at the NIRA website we're talking about. When you mentioned Saggy, it's so funny. You know, just last week in Maryland. Now it's week before, but out at Country Life, Saggy, a huge part of, you know, the legacy and the lore at Country Life.
Wow. Well, I didn't know that, but I know that, you know, just, you know, that was his one, like, real claim to fame, and then being the sire of Carryback. And the mare, Joppy, she was basically given, Jack Price, was given to Jack Price to settle a board bill and like another $150, like $300. And so you have a $300 mare and a stallion standing, I think, for $500 at that time, that created a Kentucky Derby and Preakness winner. And, you know, the fact that he wound up going to Europe and running in the Ark, and he didn't win it. But, I mean, it's pretty amazing story. But that's one of just many. And, again, Barbara opening up the collection she acquired, and which I was having a hard time wrapping my head around, too, because she's dedicated her life to, you know, documenting racing through her photographs. Then to undertake that, to go get this collection, and I mean, I was in the storage facility, and we just opened, you know, randomly opened up boxes, and the stuff you start coming upon, like, oh, here's the negative with Shenanigans, Ruffian's mother, and, you know, one thing after another. And again, Jim Raftery, he so cleverly staged a lot of the photos, particularly like it'd be the first horses shipping into Hialeah and, you know, Calumet getting off of the railroad cars that down by, you know, Barn A and Double A. And, you know, I'm not even doing it justice, but as, like, we'll be running this feature for a while, I'm sure. And thank you for bringing it up and for all the people that have been complimentary of it. But it'll lead us into other places, other photos, and you know, we'll get to share them. And instead of me trying to describe it, people will see exactly what I mean.
Well, and, you know, when you talk about the what was obviously a golden age of racetrack publicity, you know, those pictures that I take pictures of and put up when I'm at Pimlico, they make me laugh. I probably have put up only a fraction of the ones that are, you know, that are those staged type photographs, including the ones where, you know, they would take a picture of a horse at the windows and, you know, the pictures of, you know, of the trainer and rider or, you know, trainer and track management, you know, holding up a program, you know, sharing it with the horse that they're publicizing. I mean, they're so funny. And particularly the stuff around Preakness, because, you know, they've got Miss Preakness and they trot her all over town and you know, waltzing around with the, you know, the Woodlawn vase turns up in 8 million photographs. You know, there's always a picture of Miss Preakness carrying it from the bank vault, you know, to the armored car. That's my favorite.
I love it.
You know, Miss Jacqueline McGinnis, you know, 19 of Bel Air, escorts the Woodlawn Vase, to, you know, into the Brinks truck for its ride to Pimlico. It's
so great. Well, you know, though, it's great because it's supposed to be fun. I feel so strongly about how, you know, things should be marketed and things, you know, how we should present things. And I think sometimes we get lost in so much of the business end of it. And I'm not obviously saying that's unimportant. It is, but I think there's a balance someplace of keeping it fun and being able to catch maybe some mainstream attention by being clever, being creative. You know, it wasn't even that long ago, but so 1988, I broke my neck and, you know, was already never going to ride again. Well, I came back on Thanksgiving Day and they staged the whole photo, me and Carmella. I dressed in a suit to go to the races that day. It was my first ride back. And because it's Thanksgiving Day, they put this whole spread on the table. It was this big, huge roast turkey and all the fixings, everything, just so Carmella and I could sit there and they would take a photo, you know. And the next day it was in the Daily News, you know, Richard McGleary has a lot to be thankful for. But they staged the whole thing with this whole Thanksgiving banquet up in the Equestris at Aqueduct. You know, things like that. I just think it's clever. And you know, it was on the back page of the Daily News, you know, this photo that Bob Cognini staged, you know. So it's, pretty cool stuff.
Well, and I've got tons of those, you know, the pictures. There's so many of the things when I was watching the video, you know, there's all of those files that, in fact, I just brought this up the other day in conversation with Tom Law and Joe Clancy. The necessity of the preservation efforts. So there's... Yeah, it's funny how this has come up, I think, three times in the last couple of weeks. Yeah. And in part because I'm, you know, I go nuts with whatever I do. And I put these up because people love it. They get a huge reaction. The Easygoer Sunday Silence stuff I put up the other day on the anniversary of their race, people went nuts. I mean, a huge thread on Facebook and all kinds of reactions on Twitter too.
Well, but that shows you how important it is, because you do get those reactions. People are into it. They love that stuff. I gotta tell you, some of the when I first went to work for NYRA after, you know, my riding career was over, getting into the video vault. There's a vault at Aqueduct that has every single stake. A lot of it is on, was on 8mm, the reel-to-reel. You know, you had the big canisters, right? And the ones that were salvageable, because those things deteriorate over time, you know, they put on to, you know, thumb drives, and they were able to transfer a lot of stuff. But I'd get in there doing research for, you know, history of the game, and I could get lost for hours. I mean, they'd have to come fish me out of there because I'd be coming on stuff. Because we have every stake from like 1960 to current day, and then every race from like 1979 to current day. Every single race that's been run in New York from probably the late 70s to current. So I'd go in, and I'd print out a horse's past performances and start finding stuff. Mostly for the shows and obviously for work, but here's two examples. My best friend in the world, David Figueroa, we left home to be jockeys together. We're 14, living at the farm. And David got too big. He was a very good rider, incredible talent. Just he wasn't going to make it from a physical standpoint. And he had ridden a couple winners, one at Meadowlands, one at Suffolk. And Dennis Bryda had a filly, Guillemarie, that I had been riding. And, you know, we talked about it, like, David's not going to be doing this much longer, and put David on Guillemarie, and she won at Belmont. So he had three career wins, one of them at Belmont Park. And every year I take him out for dinner for his birthday, August 10th. And we were talking a few weeks before his birthday, and he said that, you know, I asked about, like, Guillemarie, did he have the win picture? And he said, you know, I'm moving. I lost it. I don't know where it is. I can't find it. So I went to the video vault, pulled up her past performances, found the race, put it on a DVD, had the, you know, the guys in the truck put it on a DVD,
sure.
Went, gave it to him before he came to the house, before we were leaving to go to dinner. I said, hey, check this out. I want you to watch this race, you know. And I was able to give him the video of his lone win in New York, all the angles. And it was so funny. She won by like 6 or 8 lengths. Excuse me. And as, you know, on the head-on, he went through the wire, and he was kind of stoic, and he galloped down. He went like a 16th of a mile, and then all of a sudden, it was like he stood up and like waved his whip and celebrated. And I was like, "What happened? Did it dawn on you that you just won at Belmont?" And he goes, "No." He goes, "I had pulled so much weight to ride her, I thought I was going to pass out. I had to wait until I could steady myself before I could celebrate." But I was able to give him that as a gift, and then Carmella. My wife is incredibly hard to buy anything for. She wants nothing. She's like her grandmother, and so much. You get her something, and she goes, "Oh, we don't need that. Take it back." You know, like, and I'm like, "It's a gift." You know, I mean, one year I got her a car on her birthday, and she comes out, and the car's in the driveway, and she's like, "Oh, I don't need a new car. Take it back. Take it back. Can't take it back. I just bought the car." Like, but you know, so it was coming up on her birthday, and I don't know what to get her. And when she was, I don't know, 14, 15 years old, she went to the Ruffian Foolish Pleasure Match Race. Her brother took her. And she had a Secretariat t-shirt on because it was only a few years after that. And there was a producer from CBS who was covering the race, saw her and said, "Hey, you want to be in this feature?" So here's all these people with Ruffian t-shirts on. Remember, it was Men Against Women. Like, it was at the time Billie Jean King and Bobby Riggs and all that. And then you had all these people with Foolish Pleasure t-shirts. So they pan to the group, "Who's going to win? Foolish Pleasure," all the guys with Foolish Pleasure t-shirts. And then they pan back, "Who's going to win?" all the women with Ruffian t-shirts. And then they pan back to Carmella, who's like 15 years old, and she goes like, "Where's Secretariat?" And her family's home had burned down in 1983, and they had a videotape of that. And they lost everything in the fire. Thankfully, no one was injured, but they lost all of their photos and everything. So I go in the video vault. I found the CBS reel of the Ruffian Foolish Pleasure Match Race, and I was able to get the guys to put it on a DVD and give her that for her birthday, which, you know, what do they say, like, you know, so-and-so this much money, so-and-so that much money, this is priceless, cost me nothing, best gift I ever gave her.
Ah, that's tremendous. That's tremendous.
Yeah, it's a treasure trove in there. All the good horses that Bruce Johnstone trained for Villa Blanca when he first started training, I was trying to think of giving him something for Christmas. I pulled up, you know, Viva Sec and Raisin Dance and all these good horses he trained, and I went and had them all put on a DVD and gave it to him for Christmas. So he had all of those horses' wins. I mean, because unfortunately, those people didn't, you know, things went wrong. They didn't stay in the game because they were buying, what horses? They were buying Secretame, and who wound up being the mother of Gone West. You know, Bruce trained all those horses. So believe me, if you ever got in there, you'd be like me. We'd have to pull you out of there.
Yeah, I'm a mess when it comes to that stuff. I mean, I don't even have to go anywhere. I can do it, you know, these days with the internet, you can do it right from, you know, right from the comfort of your own home. It's nuts, the access you got to stuff. I mean, whether it's pedigree related or anything else. Nice. I'm gonna put up a couple of black and whites that that some of those publicity photos, people that I've never put up before. I was thumbing through. You'll be amused. A couple of notes, Rich. Let's take a couple of minutes and get into what went on Saturday, and because I really haven't had a chance. I had Nick Luck and Niall Brennan to appreciate Barney Curley, who passed yesterday. Really kind of, even under the circumstance, really enjoyed their reflections. On the weekend, I'm looking forward to, got to get Tommy Bush in. There were a couple of results from the weekend that literally, they were so easy to project. And you know, when you handicap, you get an idea in your head, and you say, all right, so-and-so is going to get to the lead and should be able to dictate terms, and if he's good enough, he wins. That was the impression with Get Smokin'. It kind of came down to him and Flavius in that Seek again. And, it goes out and does exactly what you anticipate. I tell you, Tom Bush, with a limited, the limited arsenal, does a tremendous job.
He does a tremendous job. He's a horseman's horseman. You know, people respect him. He doesn't have the numbers of a lot of guys. You know, when he first started training, he was training a great deal for Viola Summer. Sigmund Summer had passed, but Viola Summer had, continued in the game. And then eventually she, wound up getting out. And, that's a huge void. If you're training for somebody like that, you have a steady supply of horses. He trained for Greentree. He trained for Paul Kornman. Paul was coming off of having win. He had a horse exclusive partner. We did a lot of good with Trubulare. I mean, Tom can train a horse. It's just, I guess, there's only so many horses to go around. And obviously the good horses, people are gravitating to, the younger big guns in the game at the moment. But give Tom a horse that can run, he's going to get the most out of him. And, I love that he trained the father, right? And he's done so well with so much of the offspring. And the horse was going to get an easy lead, and we've seen this more times than not. This has been a big topic of conversation. And I have very strong opinions. I'm not saying I'm right, but these my opinions about why we see so many paceless races. Years ago, there was such a foundation created in young riders. And like, I know me, when I was working towards being a jockey, you got to a point, all I did was work horses. I didn't, at one point I wasn't even galloping horses every day. I was just the breeze rider. And I had a fifth of a second leeway. If Mr. DeMaro said go 101, I can go a minute and four fifths or 101 and a fifth, and anything other was unacceptable. I either hit it on the head or give me a fifth of a second either way. And you learn. And it's, some horses will fool you, but once you know a horse, you adjust, and you know that, this horse does things easier, so he feels like he's going slow, but he's probably doing a little more than you realize. And it's not, you don't count, you don't watch poles. It's an inherent rhythm. It's a feeling that you understand this is an eighth and 12, this is an eighth and 13, this is an eighth and 11. And I just don't think as fabulously talented as this generation of young riders is, one of the glaring holes to me is that they don't get the same foundation working as many horses. So not only do you have to develop a clock in your head, then you have to keep that clock tuned. You have to keep it in sync. So that means working a lot of horses consistently. And I think it's even been compounded more is that most trainers now have gone to putting headsets, radios, and they're telling riders, hey, you just went an eighth and 12 and two, an eighth 13. So they're not having to feel it. They're being coached. You don't have a headset in the afternoon. I remember John Kimmel pulling out a headset one day with me, and I laughed at him, and I got on the horse and rode away. Like, you tell me how fast you want to go, and I'll do it, But, again, it's developing the clock, and then it's keeping that clock tuned. And I just don't think young riders, and this is a general statement, it's not everybody, develop that clock as strongly. And then they're more comfortable following somebody. Like, well, if I go to the lead, am I going too fast? Am I going too slow? Because you can go too slow also. People will overlook that aspect of riding a front runner. And so they defer to somebody else, and you get a race where everybody comes out looking at each other. Like, who's going to take the initiative? And you know, years ago, you just wouldn't have seen races run the way they've been run. That's my opinion on why it's that way, though. I just don't think that guys have as strong a sense of pace in their head for a confluence of things, which I just stated. And honestly, I think trainers would be better off, especially when they have jockeys working their horses, to allow the riders to figure it out. Don't be micromanaging that part of it, because it hurts you in the afternoon.
Nice. I appreciate it. This result and also really the races that were involved in the cross country was the kind of my focus. What took attention for you from the weekend?
Well, I mean, you know, obviously the result of the Seek again was very satisfying with Tom Bush and that horse going wire to wire. Feel like Junior Alvarado's been struggling a little bit since he was injured, and the last couple of days feels like he's starting to shake that off and riding a bit better. But Sconson in the winning colors was, you know, I was not quite sure what to make of the race against Gamine. Was Gamine just not that good on the day? She was getting out. So was that kind of an illusion? And I think the answer is 100% no. I think Sconson's for real. And she's that classic kind of closing sprinter that I always get excited about. I think she threw her hat into the ring as a major player in the Distaff sprint division and showed it the other day. Now, Frank's Roquette, you know, kind of hopped the break and cost her best chance, but she was not beating Sconson under any circumstances the other day. Sconson looked like a winner from the half-mile pole. Big, strong filly by Include. You'd have to think a race like the Ballerina will be on her docket because she's for real. I was very, very impressed.
No doubt. The tactical speed aspect that she's starting to show with added maturity, you know, it doesn't – she can be kept – you worry when you've got a – when you got what you imagine is a one-run closer, that if you keep them, you know, a little bit, you know, in the race flow, if you have them, you know, try to place them mid-pack, are you going to take away, are you going to blunt their late run? And she, starting to see what start number, this was start 12, and, you know, you get the sense that, you know, she's going to be a very dangerous commodity adjusting to paces. I mean, that if they're going slower, she can be put in the race earlier, and, she can be placed anywhere. I mean, she ended up winning by, well, the chart margins, 3.25. It felt like, she was winning by a pole.
Well, because she was widening every step the last 16th of a mile.
Exactly.
You know, the further they were going, the more distance she was going to put between her and the field. Just what you're saying, though, because she traveled into the bridle so beautifully, leaving the half-mile pole, and Tyler kind of tucked her in a little bit, and you know she took the kick back well, never came off the bit at all, and you just knew when he tipped her out she was going to lengthen it even more, and it was pretty to watch. It reminded me of mare I used to ride many years ago, Island Charm, who was a closing sprinter, who just would lengthen like that, particularly when she tipped out into the clear. I was really impressed with that. Now, to be fair, too, it was after 8 on a very long day for me, so maybe I was a little punchy, but I still think what I saw was for real.
Yeah, no doubt. There was a couple other races. I mean, it's funny. I had a terrific Saturday from a capping front and actually hit the middle and late pick 4 at Churchill, but I was really upset with myself for missing the cross country and the late pick five at Churchill, and the reason was the same for one race at Belmont and one race at the Downs. The nightcap, Rich, at Belmont, that Emma and I, and then the maiden special at Churchill on the 7th with Seaside Retreat. And both of these maidens, to me, looked like horses that just, you know, I wanted to use as many other potential players as possible, including a firster, and you know, it just looked like the two of them, they looked like the same kind to me, that are, you know, there was always going to be somebody that was going to jump up and beat them, and just a little too aggressive to, you know, to be against both of them, or, you know, to not, you know, not use them even properly as a backup. So I was really kind of miffed at the way I structured things with those two winners, and it's funny because I kind of looked like a winner with Emma, with the race involving Emma and I. That one was particularly, I don't know, anguished, because I that Dancing Firefly, the first time starter for Gargan, looked okay to me, and in fact had a nice workout report from Mike Vesey and the guys from the DRF Clocker report. So I thought, you know, when Dancing Firefly with Carmouche took over, I thought, all right, good, kick away. And then here came, you know, here came Jose Ortiz off the rail with Emma and I, and the same thing actually. It was a very similar kind of a result at Churchill with Shug's horse, who, you know, kind of came at will and picked off that Princess Leah, and there was Bull Tactics was arriving too late. Anyway, I cashed some tickets on Saturday, but blew it. Yeah,
I'm not good with the multi race wagers. I've tried, and I've gotten lucky here and there, but I need to, you know, I'm more, I kind of combine the visual, what I see, with what I've handicapped on paper. And, you know, right. I still kind of go back. I lean on how I think race is going to be run. Like, I kind of handicap them like I'm riding the race, and I want the layout of the race. And then I try to figure out then, like, who would I want to ride? Because, wow, this horse is probably the best horse in the race, but he's going to be compromised because isn't there a lot of pace, or there's a lack of pace, you know, like along those
sure.
lines. That's how I kind of approach it. And then I kind of do better when I get to see the horses. Now, I did hit a pick five a few weeks ago, and I was so happy and proud, but I think I almost did it by accident. Like, it wasn't, you know, I got lucky, let's put it that way. So, but like, here's a perfect example. You know, I've had multi-race tickets, and then I'll see a horse that I left out and go, God, this horse looks too good. I should have put this horse in. And then I'll see the horse that I have in and go, I don't like the way this horse is warming up, or I don't like the way it looks in the paddock, and I can't do anything about it because I'm locked in. So
right.
I've kind of stepped a little bit back from that, and here's a perfect example. Chad Brown had two in. The other day, Saratoga, I can't remember her name now. Anyway, the one that wasn't
yeah.
preferred, right? She was 9-1, and I'm looking at her in the paddock. I was reporting, and she hadn't tried the turf yet. Huge flat turf foot on her, long pastern. She looked like a turf horse to me, and she had run well on the dirt. And I was like, 9-1, getting Chad Brown and Brad Ortiz on a horse
right.
to me that looks absolutely. So I made a nice win bet on her, and I hit the exacta really well with the other Chad Brown, and it came back $27 for a buck, and I had a $20 exacta with the 9-1 on shot, and then a nice win bet on her, and it totally made my day. And I just think that for me, at least until maybe I get more comfortable with handicapping the multi-races, I've got to play to my strength, which is seeing visually and just going race to race. I mean, I obviously the bigger payoffs are with the multi-races, but I would have never had that filly on my ticket in the multi-race
sure.
because I wouldn't have had lead eyes on her, right? So, But, I'm enjoying that aspect of it. It kind of keeps you very, very focused, and it helps with your TV when you're actually, putting up your own money. It really makes you dissect the race. I'm very, very careful not to allow what I've wagered to affect how I really see it. I think that's our responsibility doing television, to present the facts, not, it's easy. I've seen it from myself. It's easy to say, that guy rode the horse bad because the horse got beat and you had money on it. In reality, if you look at it clearly, you go, he gave that horse every chance. What am I saying?
I love it. I love it. Rich, I'm going to have Dennis Drazen join us, and Dennis joining us here at the top of the hour with the situation at Monmouth coming to a head. They're going to start putting the cards together and opening up this weekend, and it's a bit of a situation with this whip rule. So we'll see what Dennis has to say.
Well, again, I think extremes in anything is the wrong way to go. I know that's not Dennis's doing. That's it's state regulated. Not I'm sure he would probably like some sort of compromise or middle ground. So it's not his fault, but. I had a conversation with somebody who, when we're on opposite ends of this debate, I think there's middle ground. I don't think that they should be as extreme as they're being. This other person thinks that's the right thing. We had an intelligent disagreement conversation about it. And I just said, well, at the end of the day, if I was riding right now, I would just choose not to ply my trade there. That would be my decision, because I'm a professional and I'm out there doing something that very few people can actually do. And then I'm going to be inhibited to do my job and react naturally the way I would if I'm not trusted as a capable horseman, capable rider, and my natural instincts are going to be inhibited. Well, you've just taken a very dangerous job and made it infinitely more dangerous. I wouldn't ride under those kind of guidelines. I just, that would be my choice. And I'm not trying to tell anybody else what to do, but if I was riding, I just wouldn't ride that.
Well, and we'll see. Joe Bravo had that at least initial thought, and they're looking to put a room together of about 15 to 20. So we'll see what Dennis can tell us and the expectation for the first draw tomorrow. Rich, this was great. I appreciate it. And get those cars serviced, and I will talk to you next week.
I look forward to it, Steve. Have a great day.
Well, and we'll be at Belmont live next Monday as well, Memorial Day. So we're looking forward to, being it's one of those rare Memorial Day before Belmont Day kinds of a week. Dennis Drazen joins us from Monmouth Park. And Dennis, good morning.
Good morning, Steve. Nice
Dennis,
to chat with you again.
can we have a conversation that doesn't have a backdrop of horror and terror and doom and gloom?
Well, you and I had a lot of conversations about sports betting over the years, so that wasn't horror, doom and gloom, except
that's
for the
true.
League, as it turned out. It's always a pleasure speaking to you, and I guess today is the call about the new whip rule in New Jersey.
Yeah, it is, and there's been. Let me try to think of who's spoken about it or to it. Kelly Breen a couple of weeks ago, Joe Bravo too, after he had a grade one win, and I floated it. That's about a month ago. Tell us where we are, Dennis, and what the expectation is for John Himes and the racing office, and how you're gonna deal with the situation.
Well, first of all, everybody. Should begin the conversation by understanding that, Monmouth Park supports our jockeys. We're most concerned about their health, welfare, not only the jockeys, but of the horses that compete. We think the primary concern of everybody should be on their welfare and making sure, that these guys who go out and risk their lives every day are protected. Having said that, I think, you know, the truth needs to be told that the jockeys really didn't show up for 2 years to engage in this process. So the jockeys are represented by the guild. And, you know, I've had a number of conversations with Joe Bravo and with Terry Meeks and with anyone else that calls me about this. But, you know, the Racing Commission started this process 2 years ago. And they had public meetings. They published notices. They asked the jockeys for their input. If I was representing these jockeys, which I wasn't, the guild was, I would have had a dozen jockeys show up at every hearing from early on and testify, you know, about their position, their concerns, and give the commissioners, you know, more information. Now, I want to be fair to the guild. The guild was engaged from the beginning. You know, the guild did retain counsel. The guild did, you know, present their position, not only at public meetings, but in writing. And others showed up. We showed up, the Mom and Park NJTAJ showed up, Derby Development showed up, the Jockey Club showed up. You know, we all submitted our positions, and the Racing Commission, excuse the expression, was hot to trot, you know, about imposing a whip rule. And there isn't one person I've talked to, Joe Bravo, Terry Meeks, Chris McCarron, you know, a number of other leading jocks, you know, they all tell me they believe the whip rule should be changed. So this is not a question of whether the whip rule should be changed. And there's a lot of, you know, pressure from organizations like PETA and the public, you know, who is concerned. So it breaks down like this, in my mind. You know, we want to support the jockeys. You know, my main conversations have been with Joe Bravo. We both agree that, you know, if a horse is way out in front, 10 lengths or more, you know, there's really no reason to be whipping and driving on that horse, particularly if no one's around. You know, unless you get in a situation like the horse tries to get in, the horse tries to get out, you need to use the whip to control the horse. But under the Jersey rule, where you can use it, you can use the crop. You know, for any circumstances where you feel you need to protect yourself or the horse, where there could be an injury, you can use the whip. So, you know, in those situations, I think we're good. Joe Bravo and I have talked about, you know, the horse that's 20 behind the field, and there's no chance catching up. You know, you're at a horse. There's no one that should be, you know, using a crop on that horse. Those two situations, you know, we think are covered. The more concerning situations is, I believe, a jockey, all of them, have to be able to use their judgment and their instincts and their experience based upon 30, 40 years of riding, or less or more, depending upon who they are. But they instinctively know when there could be an incident. The incident doesn't always develop, but like in the conversation with Joe, it's okay. You know, there's a hole opening up in front of me, and I've got to get through that hole. And instinctively, I think that that hole's going to close and there could be an incident. They must be able to use a whip to get through that hole. And in my mind, you know, that's, again, something that could cause an injury, and, you know, they should be able to use their discretion. And I would be hopeful that the stewards would recognize that these jockeys put their lives in their hands, and you have to take their word for it almost if they feel instinctively that there's about to be a problem. So I think, you know, we're on the same page on that one. But I think the place where Joe is correct, and, you know, some of the horsemen have talked to me about this, the trainers are concerned. The players, you know, the people who bet on races are concerned. You're on a horse that's five behind the field. Let's just say, you know, for argument's sake, it's a turf race, but it doesn't matter if it's turf or dirt. Trainer told you this horse doesn't have a lot of speed. I just want you to, you know, let the race develop. And when you turn for home, you know, you need to hit the horse to get him going into the race and give him momentum. So Joe says to me, so Dennis, you know, in that situation, I'm five behind the field. I got plenty of horse. I'm turning for home. I have to hit that horse in order to get him going. Otherwise, I have no chance. And he's right. But the rule does not permit him to hit the horse under those circumstances. So Joe has a problem with that aspect of the rule. And, you know, in fairness to him, you know, from his perspective, you know, in trying to ride a horse and win a race, you know, he's right. The rule does not let him whip the horse. The commission is confronted with, you know, some public outcry. And, you know, let's be honest about it. You know, between PETA and the public, you know, there's a lot more scrutiny of racing, you know, than there was, you know, 5 years ago. I mean, once Santa Anita started with all the breakdowns and PETA got involved and, you know, PETA became more active and they're organized. You know, they, you know, have hundreds and hundreds of thousands of members and, you know, they are organized to communicate with our legislators and they write them and they tell them what they think. And so there's a little more public scrutiny about this. And the chairwoman of the Racing Commission decided that, you know, she wanted to address it and there needed to be a whip rule. Now, in opposing the rule, and you have to remember, this is a two-year process, I was very aggressive because the original version was they didn't want him to carry a whip, and that would have been disaster. So they backed off that. And then they tried to determine under what circumstances could you use the crop. And, you know, I think that in going through the discussion, we urged them to wait for a national rule. We tried to point out that at that point in time, and this is 2 years ago, there was proposed federal legislation, and the pushback from the commission at that time to me was, you know, yeah, but it only addresses medication. It does not talk about safety. So then I go down to Washington, and others did too, and we testified in front of the legislature and, you know, Congress. And in particular, Congressman Pallone's committee, who this was going through, you know, heard our concerns. And, you know, we felt very strongly, those of us that felt that HISA didn't go far enough, we felt racetrack safety had to be a primary concern. I testified about jockeys, you know, and the crop and needing a national rule. And then, you know, HISA was finally passed with not only medication reform, which is good, but also, you know, racetrack safety and trying to make these racetracks safety and address things like, you know, protecting the jockeys under these circumstances and getting a rule that everyone can get behind. But to be honest, you know, the development of a rule in this country, you know, as it relates to this particular issue is different from jurisdiction to jurisdiction. Moving in the right direction, but I don't think jockeys should have to be confronted with six times here and nine times there and
right.
A couple of times and then let them recover. And, you know, it's, these jockeys go all over the country. And when you're in the heat of battle and you're trying to, you know, protect your life, you know, to have to then remember, let's see, can I do it six times here or am I in a nine time jurisdiction or is it overhand? Is it underhand? You know, it needs to be national, and I'm very hopeful that HISA, you know, will develop a national rule. But in the interim, although I have urged the New Jersey Racing Commission and every jurisdiction, frankly, to have a national rule, one size fits all, you know, primary focus is protect the jocks, protect the horses, but it hasn't happened yet. So the commission pushed back and they said, well, you know, you may want a national rule, but there isn't one. And, you know, we don't see right now that there's a chance of getting one. So I've urged the jockeys and the guild to kind of move in that direction. They right now are on appeal in the appellate division on the commission's decision to only use the whip for safety, you know, as articulated in the rule. And while this is in the appellate division, it's very difficult to have a conversation when a matter's in court, you know. And when they went to the commission asking for a stay, it was denied. When they went to the appellate division to ask for a stay, it was denied. And then while the matter was in court, you know, Kelly asked a couple of questions last week at the commission meeting, you know, and they told him this matter's in court. We really can't talk about it. And so, you know, that's where it is right now. I suggested to the Guild and to Bravo that they file a new petition for rulemaking, which I suggested they do before the last meeting, but it wasn't done. And in that new petition, it kind of sounds like this. You know, 2 years ago, there was no federal legislation. There was no place to address this on a national level. Now there is. And we would like to have new rulemaking. We think this is dangerous for the jockeys. We think it should be the same from jurisdiction to jurisdiction. That would start a new rulemaking process, but it won't be in time for our meet, which I guess is their concern. They, you know, want to address it in the appellate division because they need immediate action, which isn't going to happen. You know, it's a matter that's in the court. Someone can't just snap their fingers and make a court case go away. So I'm concerned for the jockeys' health and welfare and for the health and welfare of the horses. You know, that should always be my primary concern.
Sure.
But by the same token, you know, we are where we are at this point, and Monmouth Park can't just snap its fingers and fix this when the commission regulates us. You know, I can't make it go away. And the only one that can make it go away is a court right now. And the matter's not going to be reached in the court before the meet starts. So what are the jockeys doing? So I'll start with Joe, because Joe is a friend. He's a former client. I know him ever since he started riding at Monmouth Park, and I like Joe Bravo. You know, I'm a big Joe Bravo fan. But he's, you know, running a grave risk here, you know, that I've tried to make sure that he and the Guild clearly understand, you know, what position he's putting himself in. So any jockey, Joe can decide, I'm not coming to Monmouth Park. I don't like the rule. I'm going to take my tack and go ride anyplace else, and no one can do anything about it. But when he and the Guild get themselves involved in a very carefully worded attempt to create a boycott and to get other riders and or trainers to support them in the boycott, he can be called in by the commission for conduct detrimental to racing. And if this commission gets annoyed with what Joe is out there doing, no, they can suspend them, and then there's reciprocity in every state. Joe won't ride any place, you know, if the commission wants to play hardball with him. So I think he's, you know, walking a fine line. And there were a number of jockeys, you know, that were going to ride, and now they're saying, you know, Joe has had conversations with them, and, you know, they may not ride. We'll see tomorrow. But, you know, they can put themselves in jeopardy also. And there are other riders who are out there, you know. I mean, for riders to be going to trainers, both in New Jersey and in New York, and suggesting that they not ride, not enter at Monmouth, could end up in a position where whoever's involved, you know, could find themselves suspended. And then what are they going to do? They can't ride anyplace. So I would be very careful of how I conduct myself. If a jockey, you know, does not want to ride because he fears, you know, for his health and safety, not a problem. He doesn't have to come. But if they're accepting mounts and they boycott the meet, I think you're going to find them all sitting around for a long time and not racing. So I support the jockey. I don't want to see them get in trouble. I hope somebody is communicating to them about their actions and the possible consequences associated with their actions. And I certainly have communicated that potential issue But having said that, you know, I do believe that we will have enough jockeys to put on our meet. There may be some people that decide initially not to ride. And, you know, that's a decision that's their decision, you know, alone. They can make that decision. But, you know, having said that, I think there are enough other jockeys that have told us at Monmouth and told me directly that they intend to ride. They don't like the rule, but they're going to ride. And so, you know, I think, you know, come Friday night, we'll have enough jockeys to put on the card. And if not, you know, then unfortunately, you know, if you can't put on the show, Monmouth Park will sustain losses. And, you know, the question will come up, you know, what to do about it. Not trying to get ahead of myself, because I believe that we have good relationship with our jockeys colony. Even, you know, if someone doesn't want to ride, we have a good relationship with Joe. I hope we always will. But at the end of the day, you know, if we can't put on the meet, everybody gets hurt. So what would these jockeys have us do if the commission has dug in and they're not going to change it? They want us just to cancel the meet at Monmouth when we're giving away, you know, $30 million in purses and they share in that revenue. I wouldn't think they want us to cancel the meet. So I think, you know, they're probably trying to play hardball, hoping the commission's going to change their mind. And you know, I think this commission's dug in. I don't think they're about to change the mind. And even assuming hypothetically that they wanted to, well, they've repealed the old rule, so there is no rule there. They can't enact a new rule, you know, without going through the process of advertising a new rule and permitting public comment and holding
the
hearing.
Whole process. Yeah.
You know, so, you know, I think their hands are kind of tied at this point. Having said that, you know, I always, you know, try and bring parties together, and we'll continue to do so. But as of yesterday, you know, I was told, you know, this is the rule. We're going to enforce the rule. And, you know, any jockey that decides not to ride, that's their choice. But if they're going to come into New Jersey and try and disrupt things, and even in a veiled way try and organize a boycott when they try and say they're not, they're going to find themselves in trouble. And, you know, I hope all these jockeys understand that the commission has the power to suspend them and they can't ride any place. There will be reciprocity throughout the country.
Sure.
That's something that I'm concerned about for the jocks, just to make sure they're not, like, led down the primrose path, you know, saying nothing will happen. In fact, you know, from a legal standpoint, I know something can happen and will.
Dennis Drazen with us.
That's my two cents.
And Dennis, what about the horsemen? You're obviously, you know, obviously the racing office is in constant communication with everybody, and I guess it's a two-part question. Has it affected, had the specter of this affected, you know, how many stalls were filled over the past, you know, month or so? And what, you know, what can the horsemen do to reinforce your message, or, you know, line up riders to come in for, you know, to start the meet?
Yeah, so it's funny. You know, this rule's been out there for 2 years. There's been plenty of press about it, you know, long before the stall applications were due. The horsemen knew about the rule. And we had, you know, 2,000 applications for 1,600 stalls. So we're going to be overfilled. We have people calling us, begging us for stalls. So from the horseman perspective, it didn't deter them from taking stalls.
Okay.
There are some trainers, you know, who are concerned, you know, so different people express themselves. So some just kind of go along and say nothing, and some are outspoken, like Kelly. And, you know, I'm sure there is concern that, you know, number one, jockeys got to be safe. Number two, our horses have to be safe. We don't like the rule. But by the same token, Monmouth has given away a lot of money. And these horsemen, you know, have horses ready to run. And so I'm hoping that they will continue to run with us. We've had specific discussions with certain trainers who have been approached by jockeys. And there are trainers that the jockeys, some of them, there are very few jockeys that I get reports of actually being involved in this process, but there are a couple of them that went to big outfits and asked them not to enter their horses at Monmouth. And the report we got back is those trainers said they're not doing that to Monmouth. Monmouth has been good to them, and that they want to continue to support Monmouth, and they're not going to trash Monmouth's whole meet, you know, to boycott the entry box. So I would expect most trainers to support us, but, you know, in all honesty, you know, I have not talked to a trainer that told me he's going to boycott the box, but I'm sure there are some trainers that have horses, you know, that they feel need to use the crop on. And they may be reluctant to choose a race at Monmouth as opposed to a race in New York and another jurisdiction if they feel that their horse needs the crop. Then I have other horses, other trainers that have called me, and, you know, they've been a little tough on Joe. And they say, look, you know, I've ridden Joe before over the years. And, you know, my family, you know, before me, you know, has ridden Joe. And there are horses we tell him not to use the crop on, period. And he's never had a problem with that. So, you know, I guess there are circumstances where, you know, some trainers think you definitely need the crop. And others think, you know, their horse doesn't need it. So, you know, the ones that, you know, don't need it, they're going to certainly run with us. The ones that feel they need it, you know, my guess is that they may choose another jurisdiction to ride it. And then it's the people who wager. You know, I got a call from someone whose name will remain, you know, anonymous, but, you know, he's a very important person, he wages a lot of money, he comes to Monmouth all the time, he loves to, you know, bet on horses. And he said, look, Dennis, you know I love you guys over there, but, you know, I can't bet your turf races. You know, most of the horses I bet on are closers, and if the jockey can't encourage them, how am I ever going to bet a horse in those races? So you're going to lose me, you know, to the handle. And then, you know, as we have the conversation, you know, and we talk a little bit more about their handicapping, you know, they say, well, you know, I guess I could handicap differently, and I can take a turf race, and, you know, I can bet on the horses that have speed and, you know, that I think will be in front, thinking that if they can't use the crop, the others aren't going to catch them. So he says, maybe I'll continue to bet with Monmouth. You know, I like the action, but I'm certainly not going to bet as much as I used to bet until I get a better feel for this. And that's nothing different, and I hate to bring up another controversy, but nothing different than the Lasix decision.
That's what I was going to bring into it. I mean, it's the same. Everybody's sort of feeling their way, and you know, personal decision and comfort level, and you know, it seems like the same kind of scenario.
Yes, I've had the same conversations with Lasix that I'm having on the whip, except more so that they're more upset about the possibility of, you know, having form on a horse based on the fact he's using Lasix, and now he's in a stake and he can't use it. So, you know, how do I bet with confidence? They've told me the same thing. But I don't want to walk down the Lasix path. I'm just bringing it up because
sure.
It's
a parallel. Yeah.
That we have, you know, often. But my job is to put on the show. So, yeah, I've got to, you know, let my office take entries tomorrow and, you know, get ready for Friday and Saturday and hope that everything will be okay. And, you know, I wish that there was a solution to this, but I believe the commission is dug in. The rule's not going to change. I think this is a job for, you know, HISA. So the safety committee will address it. I know that, you know, the jocks told me, you know, and you have to process what you're told. So, you know, I had a conversation with Joe, and Terry, and they said, well, they believe that the Jockey Club is on their side, and they're opposed to the rule. So Mr. Gagliano was going to call me the next day, so I pulled the Jockey Club position that they advanced to the Racing Commission in writing when the rule was being considered. And they supported the rule 100%, told them to sign it, and told them it was in line with the Jockey Club thinking. So Jockey Club wrote a letter after that, a couple of days ago, to the commission, and you know, reinforced that they support the issue and support what the commission did. But they're asking them, you know, given the fact that we do now have HISA, they're asking them to, you know, wait on the implementation of the rule until this can be addressed on a national level. And I don't think the commission's about to, you know, stop the process. As of yesterday, we were told the rule's in effect, and you know, it's going to be in effect on opening day. And you know, we hope the jockeys are going to cooperate, but we're prepared to take action if they don't. That's kind of what we're looking at here.
Hmm. Well, this will be the most interesting overnight that tomorrow that, in anyone's recent memory.
Yeah, but you know, when you talk about the, we're going to take entries regardless. You know,
sure.
if they can't name a rider, you know, we'll wait and hope that something happens between now and the weekend. But you know, we're going to take entries, and you know, we're going to, you know, act like it's a normal meeting, and we're going to miss guys like Joe. You know, Joe is, they call him Jersey Joe. You know, Joe is Monmouth Park.
Yep.
You know, so I'm upset that Joe is, you know, troubled by all this and feels that, you know, his life is in jeopardy, and I get that Joe has to do what he feels he has to do. But we want to support our jocks, and we want them to be safe, and you know, I wish some other things were happening that, again, I can't control. So I urge the commission to develop written pamphlets, both in English and Spanish. And I understand they're doing that, so the rule will be clear, but hasn't been distributed yet. I urge them to meet with our jockeys to explain the interpretation of the rules. So if a jockey is concerned that he can't go through an opening without urging the horse because the opening may close, to me, that's an instance where jockey should be able to use the crop because it's a safety concern. So, you know, you need to see how our stewards are going to enforce it. So if a jockey turns around and says, I needed to use the crop to get through the hole because it was going to collapse on me and, you know, might have clipped heels, might have, you know, caused injury to the other horses, might have ended up in the hospital myself. Yeah, I think a steward's got to listen to them and, you know, give them a pass on those things. But it's important for the stewards to be meeting with our jockeys, and we're a little handicapped by the fact the jockeys aren't here. You know, they come in from other jurisdictions.
Right.
They don't come in weeks before the meet. We don't have a year-round process. So those meetings are going to take place, but can't take place till everyone's here. And to me, that's really not enough time. You know, it's going to be a learning process. And, you know, you have to almost say, time out, let's put the rule in effect and kind of play with it for a while and let jockeys and stewards get used to what's necessary. So I'm a little disappointed that, you know, that's not the process that's going on. But I understand if the jockeys aren't here, it's tough to meet with them. I tried to get the commission to organize a Zoom meeting, you know, a couple of weeks ago to kind of give everyone an advance heads up on what was happening. But I think it's, they prefer to do this face to face when everyone's here. So I think a lot of jockeys are uncertain what they can do and what they can't do. And
yeah,
that process that I went through with you earlier about what I believe that they'll be able to do is a conversation they should all be having. And, you know, this should really be our stewards and our commission sitting down with the jockeys and going through what they expect from them and, you know, having a give and take you know, back and forth to get to something that the jockeys are comfortable with. And I would urge all the parties to try and do that.
Well, and honestly, Dennis, that what you just broached is kind of really encouraging, because that hasn't been in all the coverage of this. Every time it's discussed, it's been an either or, and the fact that nobody's really said, you know what, this might be a feel it out scenario, and what might be permissible and what might not be is still to be determined. And why doesn't everybody just come in and let's get started and we'll feel our way through this? If, you know, if after a week or two, you know, you get fined and you say, you know what, I'm not riding under these circumstances. Okay, fine. But maybe give, maybe the riders, you know, give the stewards a chance to interact, and we'll find an area of what's permissible and what, you know, what goes beyond the line.
Yeah, I mean, I've even had reporters call me and go through the following scenario with me. They say, you know, Dennis, I wanted to really find out whether the horses are being hurt. So I went to sit down with a couple of these jockeys, and I asked them to hit me with the crop as hard and as often as they wanted.
Sure.
And they told me, yeah, I could feel something, but it didn't hurt.
No.
So they're telling me that with the new crop, you know, it's not like the old days where
not
you
at
have,
all.
Well, the, you know, marks, and, you know, I think, you know, everyone's got to get a better handle on this, but I'm comfortable, you know, for the future, because I think that HISA will establish through their safety arm, you know, a national rule, and that sometime, you know, hopefully by the end of 2022, going into early 23, we'll have one rule for the entire country. And I think that's what we need. And I've wasted my breath for 30 years telling everyone in the industry we need to be a real league like the major leagues, and we need to have a commissioner with power, and we need uniformity, and, you know, it just never happened, and now it's going to happen. You know, HISA is going to be something that's very good, you know, for the horse racing industry, and I get it that everyone's on a different page. Now, not everyone, but there are some that are on a different page with HISA, and you know, they have their concerns, and I'm not being critical. But I think at the end of the day, you know, there is going to be federal legislation, and it's going to control the issues that the majority of the organizations, you know, that support racing feel are necessary changes that we need to make to get us to the next level. And, you know, in a couple of years, I think we're going to have that, and everyone's going to be a lot happier. But kind of like, you know, you need to have the patience of a saint sometimes. And, you know, everybody's been patiently waiting for these changes, and now it's on the horizon. And I wish it was here now as it relates to the jockey problem, because we do need uniformity. We need a national rule, and we all have to be on the same page. But, you know, you could probably look at anything that's going on and say, you know, can HISA solve these problems? And, you know, we have to be optimistic for the future, because, you know, we have an industry that we all treasure and love and want to keep it here forever. And it's important we get it right. So whatever the concerns are on the jockey whip rule, I'm sympathetic to their health and safety. But the only way to solve this is have one national rule that everybody can live with.
Yeah. Well, Dennis, I appreciate this, because I, you know, rather than wait till tomorrow and draw day, and wanted to kind of get out in front so everybody, you know, is aware, and sounds like there might, we'll see. Well, there's no reason to speculate. We'll just let it happen, and we'll have an appropriate meet preview in a few days with Memorial Day, with the programs, you know, getting established.
Yeah, it's Monmouth Park right now. You know, we're geared up for a good meet. We have good purse money. We have plenty of, you know, horses to support the meet. You know, it's unfortunate that we are where we are, but that's horse racing.
Yeah, we find ourselves in any number of tight spots, and at least in Oceanport, to get out of that tight spot, you got a hand ride. Dennis, I appreciate it.
You don't have to hand ride. You have to use the whip as the rule permits you to.
There you go. All right, better. That's a better. That's a better. That's a better framing. I appreciate.
Listen, I've been with people who I love. You know, and they're racing enthusiasts, and, you know, they are friends. But, you know, sometimes they see a couple of jocks, you know, going down the lane and, you know, hitting the horses incessantly, and they say, Dennis, you know, we're not saying anything because we, you know, don't want to be critical, but, you know, this is hard to watch. So I get the concern, and I think the jockeys support change. There's not one jockey I've spoken to that doesn't support some change. But then, you know, the funny thing is you go back 5 years and, you know, it was, well, the jockeys aren't riding out the races. You know, we have customers that are complaining that they lost the try. They lost the superfector because the jockeys, you know, wrap up on the horses. And they were complaining that the jockeys, you know, should be encouraging the horses more. You can never make anyone happy. Can't make everyone happy.
No, that's true. That's true. Dennis, I appreciate this, and we're certainly looking forward to the season and Haskell and everything that comes with it, and we'll do a preview going into Memorial Day. But I think at least everybody knows where things are, you know, heading into tomorrow, so I appreciate it.
You going to come visit us this year for Haskell?
Of course, of course.
Good. Good.
Of course, without fail.
You'd be welcome as always.
I appreciate it. Dennis Drazen, everybody. And the Mama season will start on Friday. And we'll know more as the week progresses. And looking forward to the opening action. Some stakes this weekend, too, to get going. We will turn our attention. We've got about 20 minutes left. Brendan Walsh is standing by. And maybe not. Did we lose Brendan? Case, is that Brendan, or was that Dennis? Let's see. Brendan. No, we lost Brendan. Okay. All right. Casey will get Brendan Walsh back. This is a difficult equation. I mean, I was trying to make the best of it in terms of, you know, the way Dennis phrased the, you know, the stewards handling the rule, because they are the immediate, you know, they're the immediate adjudicators of it. So, you know, if the jocks say this was a safety issue, I needed to use the stick in the way I did for that reason, there might be leeway, right? Is that what everybody heard? I think Brendan Walsh. I think I can hear Brendan in the background. Brend, good morning.
Hey, Steve. How are you doing?
I'm great. I wanted to congratulate you and the Pocket Aces team. We've got, as it happens, we've got a common owner that's involved with Pocket Aces, our friend Dave Brown. He's in on a handful of our horses, too. And we talked about Temple City Terror extensively. Going into the weekend, she just keeps improving little by little by little.
Yeah, I know she did, and she seemed to relish the mile and a half, Steve, which I wasn't surprised, but on the same hand, I wasn't confident either, you know. But she sure did get it, no problem. So it opens a big door for her, I guess.
Well, and yeah, this was an overnight stake, but it's still a nice win for, you know, for her and for the Pocket Aces team. And like you say, if she's going to enjoy a trip like that, there's all kinds of opportunity. She also just seemingly attended the pace and moved when Adam asked. I mean, she did everything you could have wanted.
Yeah, no, absolutely, she did. She was a little more prominent than what she had been going
Yeah.
shorter distances, and I think it fitted her well, and she finished great, Steve, you know. So we're very happy with her because she's a filly. She's a sweetheart of a filly. You know, she always tries her heart out. You know, it took her a long time to break her maiden. I think it took her 8 or 9 runs before she broke her maiden. You know, but ever since she's done that, she, you know, she's gone from strength to strength. But she's never once run a bad race, you know, without there being some kind of a reason. So, you know, hats off to her. And, you know, it's great for them guys. There's a big syndicate of people that we could hardly fit everybody in the winner's circle on Saturday night. And Mark Wampler heads that up, Steve, and he does a great job. And they're just great people to train for. They seem like they get a great thrill out of the game. So it's that's all we need right now.
Well, and, you know, she obviously enhances her value. She, you know, she's a Temple City out of a more than ready mare, and if she's going to add these kinds of stripes, and especially, you know, already came into it, stakes placed from the Al Stahl Memorial over the winter at Fairgrounds, you know, that's another aspect of this too. I want to mention that was on yielding turf at Fairgrounds, and she's also won on good ground. So essentially, and this was firm, she's basically getting over any kind of turf course, which has got to be encouraging.
Yeah, I think she pretty much goes on anything, Steve, you know, which is great when you don't have to worry too much about the way a surface is going to be. So, no, it's all pretty positive with her right now.
That's for sure. Well, plenty of summer opportunities, Midwest or elsewhere. Anything come to mind immediately, or you're gonna start looking over condition books?
Not really yet. We'll see how she comes out of it. We'll give her a few days and come up with a plan then, Steve. But there's nothing really, you know. Well, we just have to give it some consideration, and then talk to the people and that, and see how she does the next few days and go from there.
Well, I know at least one member of Pocket Aces that's rooting for a Saratoga trip. They would want you to bring her here. So, just FYI.
Uh-huh. Okay. We'll see.
All right. Well, yeah. I mean, you can take advantage from your base. There's all kinds of options, no doubt. Let me touch base too on some other things before I bring up. We got to talk about the extravagant way in a minute, and then I'm going to ask you about your thoughts on the passing of Barney Curley. But the barn got hot here over the, you know, over the last, let's call it a month. I know Family Way as well on Friday got that win, but things are kind of hot right now.
Yeah, no, we're having a good run. You know, we had a good meet at Keeneland without being too successful as far as visiting the winners' enclosure was concerned, Steve, but the horses had run really well. There were a bunch of seconds and thirds, so I think they were, you know, they were starting to come and hit some pretty good form. So, you know, it's nice that they've, you know, you still have to go and get it done, but it's nice that they've carried it over to Churchill. And, of course, Churchill is our home track pretty much, so it's a big meet for us every year, the spring meet, so it's nice to be doing well, you know.
No doubt. And since Derby weekend, in fact, Lake Lucerne with an allowance win, and Ethical Judgment as well, and you know, then I mentioned Family Way from Friday afternoon. So there's been a nice drumbeat, and of course you go back to, you know, the big weekend, and there, you know, Maxfield, who we'll talk about here as well, but there's been a slew of these, really. The uncle, the win. Did we talk about that win as well during? I can't remember if we talked after. Did we talk about after Maxfield Derby weekend? Yeah, about Max.
No,
also
I think we had a little bit of.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And
yeah,
because
into, you know, here one day.
I did, actually. I kept pushing. That's right. There was like 3 days in a row. That's right. We kept trying to reach you. So we haven't talked about Maxfield or about Intimistic, who won that Unbridled Sydney during the week.
Yeah. Yeah.
Now, start with Maxfield, and you know, you came back from California with him. Wins the Ali Sheba, and how ambitious is the schedule? You know, you obviously got the Foster coming up. When
the 26th, I believe, or the 28th, whatever that last Saturday in June.
Yeah, the week from the 28th.
Yeah, so he's doing great. He worked back on Saturday. And worked well. You know, he's pretty consistent workhorse. And worked good. So he's doing great. He looks fantastic. Came out of the race at Churchill the last day in good shape. So we're kind of gearing up to get him ready to go again here for the Foster. Hopefully, you know.
Nice. And haven't checked lately how the. Where the field, you know, we're so Triple Crown oriented, so we will start to look ahead to next week. This or is it? When is it? I mean, I'm losing track here of what's today. what is today's the 24th? Is that right?
The 24th today. Yeah. Yeah.
Unbelievable. Sure. Holy cow. All right. So I guess I
better. Year is flying by.
Yeah, exactly. What about Intimistic?
Intimistic ran great, Steve. You know, again, she's been a model of consistency all year. Was a little unlucky at Keeneland. Her start before the last day in the Unbridled Sydney. And, you know, just got. You know, just kind of had too much, kind of, you know, just got left out in the front a little early at Keeneland through no fault of her own or of her rider. They would have actually worked out better had they made it a little more difficult for her, I think. But, you know, she came out of it really good, and we said we'd take a shot back in the Unbridled Sydney, and, you know, she was able to just sit off the pace there and tip out, and it worked out much better for her. But she's been a model of consistency all year. So, you know, very, very pleasing to win that race with her as well for some good people.
Well, and we'll talk, speaking turf sprinting, we'll talk Extravagant Kid as well. But I do want to ask you about where things stand with Prevalence.
We're going to give him a little time off, Steve. He just came out of the race the last day with some bone bruising, so we're just going to give him a little holiday, and hopefully we'll have him back again in the fall. Nothing wrong with him at all, just that, and you know, normally time takes care of that, and that's what we're going to do. So we'll look forward to getting him back in the fall. If we get him back to 100%, he could be anything, you know.
Well, and give him. There's plenty of 3-year-olds that went through this winter grind, and you know, a little time off helps. How about Zafel? Right? I mean, how about Zafel's performance? He ran third in the distaff turf.
Yeah, I thought she ran. You know, she ran well enough, Steve. You know, through no fault of her own, I think she was just a victim of maybe not enough pace. We would have liked to have had. More pace up front. Chad filly got alone on the lead, and she's a very, very good filly in her own right. You know, nobody took her on, which there was a filly scratched out of it that morning that probably, you know, might have sat up and taken her on. But it didn't materialize in the end. And, you know, after going 2 or 3 furlongs, we knew we were possibly in some trouble. You know, and I think, you know, she still did well to run on for third, and you know, listen, you know, the other fillies ran really well under the circumstances too, but unfortunately wasn't to be our day, but hopefully it won't be too long and she'll be backfiring again.
Nice. The Ascot plans, extravagant kid. How you shaping up for the trip to Ascot?
Good. He's doing great. He walked here, I think Friday morning we walked him, and he walked really well. And he seems like he's doing really good. So we're trying to firm up plans for him at the moment. But he's due to fly out the beginning of next week. I think the first or the second is when his flight is expected to leave. So we're just trying to tie up some loose ends at the moment. But it's all organized, and you know, we're all set to go. So really, really looking forward to that now, Steve. You know, that should be a great trip. It's great to be a part of something like that, and hopefully it'll work out as good as Dubai did.
Well, that was sort of the success on which you think about something like this. I floated the question earlier this morning, knowing we were going to talk. Do you have your own morning jacket and top hat outfit, or you got to get fitted?
I have. I had a very fancy friend got married a couple of years ago, Steve, and he had top hat, or not top hats, actually tails on it. So I have that part of the equation anyway. So now I have to try and find a hat. But I don't know that I'm going to go because they're still pretty restricted in England at the moment, and they're wanting Charlie, my guy who's gone out to England with the horse, he has to go out tomorrow and do 5 days self-isolation out there before the horse gets there. And he's got to do a bunch of tests and that too. So I'm hoping that restriction may be lifted by the time we would go out there. But if it's not, then I don't know that I can lock myself away for 5 days and come out. A, we're just very busy, and B, I don't know if I could hold my sanity together being locked up for 5 days, Steve.
Well, people are hoping that the restrictions are eased, so because everybody wants to see you in the outfit. That's the best part of these trips. That's the trip part of the trip that is the best for horse players and fans in America is seeing, you know, how everybody looks. Well, we're looking forward to Extravagant Kid taking him on at Royal Ascot. And speaking of starts coming up, how about Friday? You're looking for a maiden breaker with the Honor Code filly Honorably.
Yeah. You know, she's a filly. She's very fast, Steve. She ran, you might remember the race at Keeneland. She's run her first two starts on dirt, had been working really well at home. You know, her last run at Keeneland, she hit the gates running and turned for home. Looked like she just had to pick up a little to win the race, and she didn't really finish out the race. So we're going to try the turf. I'm hoping the turf might just get a little bit more out of her, but she does show plenty of talent at home, so you know, wouldn't surprise me at all if she were to run a bang up race. She's drawn widest of all, which I think is going to help us on this occasion.
Nice.
You know, we try and get a little cover and you know, definitely shows enough talent at home to win a race, to win a maiden, but she's still got to produce it on the racetrack.
She's an Honor Code out of a More Than Ready mare, so the turf aspect, the blinkers come off as well. This is the ninth race on Friday. And finally, just about a minute or so, you know, I had Nick Luck earlier and Niall Brennan, who, of course, his dad Liam trained Yellow Sam. Brendan, thought about Barney Curley.
I met the man on an once or twice. Steve, he was a good friend of a few friends of mine. You know, but he was a great man. You know, he was controversial at times, but you know, he meant well. You know, he did some fantastic work out in Africa for the missions and for charity and stuff like that. And anybody that knew him well always spoke very highly of him. Obviously, super shrewd operator when he was training, you know, and a great character of the game. So I'm sure he's going to be terribly missed, you know, but you know, was a fantastic man and was always only meant positive things from what people tell me. So, you know, but just a fantastic character. I mean, if anybody ever gets a hold of his book, Giving a Little Back, it's a fantastic read.
Yes.
And it's very interesting, you know.
Brendan, this was
very
great. I appreciate it. Brendan Walsh, everybody. Brent B. Walsh. Plus, we had Dennis Drazen and Mig and Niall Brennan and Nick Luck. Talk to you in the morning.
Thanks, Steve.
It's At the Races with Steve Bick on Sirius XM Radio.
Why, in the past decade, has BRL Equine become the premier equine supplement company in the industry? Because we spend millions in research and development before we ever put out a product. Because we use only FDA-supervised facilities to manufacture for us. Because what we say is in them is in them. Because they work. Because if you're not happy, I'll give you your money back. And because top trainers and veterinarians in thoroughbred racing, standardbred racing, three-day eventing, and barrel racing all trust in BRL Equine. Shouldn't you? To find out more how Flexify HA, Unlock, Bleeder Shield, and EPO Equine can help you, contact me, Joseph Vellante, 215-501-6880.